Moving on to another issue facing women, federal funding for abortions.
The Hyde Amendment I have opposed constantly. There's no reason why poor women, and that's what they are if they're under Medicaid, and that's what the Hyde Amendment is directed toward, should not have the right to determine within the purview of the Supreme Court's decision as to timing, as called the trimester test, just like women who can afford to go to a clinic or a hospital and not look to the government for a medical care. It is an element of medical care. All that has been contended for by me and by Senators Brooke and Packwood, we have been the three leading proponents of this proposition, is that where it is required for the health of the woman who is under Medicaid, she's entitled to have it, just like another woman would who didn't have to look to Medicaid. We haven't contended for anything else. And the restriction to incest or threat of death is simply discriminating against poor women. So I'm against the Hyde Amendment, and I'm certainly against the constitutional amendment to make it a crime to have an abortion. Because the Supreme Court has laid down what is a fair adjustment of the demands of the state and the demands of the individual, as I say, based upon a time period. And that adjustment is socially acceptable, obviously from all the polls, to the overwhelming majority of the American people, is a great element in women's equal opportunity to express themselves and what they wish to do with their own bodies, and I believe is a very fair resolution of this hot social issue, and that those who oppose it are opposing the mores of our time. They're not that's said in approving them, not disapproving.
Senator, you mentioned the poor, and the standard bearer of your own party has indicated that he is proposing a 30% tax cut over a 3-year period, and indicated in his inaugural address that by he would look over certain federal programs, and as I understood him to say, by executive order, make some changes if some needed to be made. Would this cut into the very social programs which become part and parcel of our political system at this point?
I don't understand Governor Reagan advocating the enactment of a 30% tax cut. That would not only cut into many of these programs, even the most essential, in health, education, and the care of the aged, and many, many other things that are essential to society. But could eliminate but he's not contending for that in law. That's his personal opinion. He'd like to see a 30% tax cut, the so-called Roth-Kemp bill. But I'm against that because I think it would add materially to inflation and be a disaster for our country. What he has settled for, Reagan, and I'm with him on this, is a tax cut to stimulate the modernization of U.S. The U.S. industrial plant that is urgently needed. And that would take about 1/3 to 40% of whatever tax cut in the $20 to $30 billion range that we have. Of the balance, he's for a 10% tax cut. That's 1/3 of the 30% for this year, in order to help the individual in two ways. One, to make up for the Social Security tax increase, which he's going to have to pay beginning in 81. And secondly, to take care of what's called the bracket creep in income taxes, by which you get more dollars, which puts you in higher brackets, but doesn't improve your standard of living because of inflation. So I'm with him on the 10%. I'll settle for that. And I'm with him on the targeted tax cut to stimulate industrial modernization and thereby to do the most single important direct thing to break the inflation syndrome, and that is to materially improve America's productivity and America's competitiveness. That's absolutely right. It's something for which I've been contending for 4 years as chairman of the task force on the economy of the Republicans of the U.S. Senate.
Senator, I hear the ball passed back and forth as to who is responsible for the current quagmire of the tax structure in our country. I hear the loyal opposition claiming the GOP and members of your party saying it's the Democrats. Whose fault is it?
I think it's the fault of sectional interests in our country.
Would you define that?
Yes. The South and Southwest, especially the Southwest, is very interested in oil and gas. And so everything is done in all the trades they can make to twist the tax laws that way. And the South remains quite a conservative area. And that's where many of the tax advantages to corporations, major business, are developed. And the influence of the Midwest and the Northeast, which tend to have more and across the board people's interest, generally all kinds of people and all kinds of interest, because of our economic difficulties and the fact that we need so much in the way of unemployment compensation, and federal help with our cities and with education and health problems, has sort of muted that voice because it has to also make accommodations with representatives and senators from these other areas of the country in order to stay alive, like New York City's loan and loan guarantee program to keep out of bankruptcy. So that has tended to give us a mix of interests which results adversely to an intelligent and balanced tax structure. And that is the base of the difficulty. It's in the Congress. Our strong and gifted president, which we have not had, might be able to lead away from that syndrome, and I believe could. But where is that powerhouse? Franklin D. Roosevelt and Dwight Eisenhower are with us no longer.
Senator, it has been said that the job has become so complex and immense that not any one person can really do it effectively.
Oh, it can be done, and can be done effectively. And the president will come along who will do it effectively. I hope that president is Ronald Reagan. He has a great chance. I believe the American people want very much to elect him president. Naturally, they will hope he will let them elect him president by the kind of performance he gives in the campaign. So I believe a president will, and certainly, you know, can come along. The place is there. And the proof of that is the flap over making Gerald Ford, the former president, a candidate for the vice presidency. That absolutely collapsed. And the reason it collapsed is because we realized, and I said this myself, at the convention in Detroit of the Republican Party, that our society cannot take two bosses. You have to have one president. And the country, therefore, must, through this national official, speak with one voice. And you cannot divide that authority. If you do, it will weaken the country and divide it very seriously. So I think we've got a system of government which requires that there be a central authority. We can put lots of restrictions on that authority, as I have myself in the War Powers Resolution, for example, major restrictions on the power of the president to put us into war, which she's had up to 1973. But essentially, the country has to speak through that voice for the time being. When a president's in office, he is the USA. All the other things, the Supreme Court, the Congress, are restraints or authorizing bodies, but in the final analysis, he exercises the executive power. There's no substitute for that. It's said, for example, that New York City is a city impossible to govern, but suppose it is. You still have to do it through a mayor for the same reason, because the executive power must be spoken for by one personality.
I want to move back to the campaign for a moment. It is perhaps an issue which some regard as legitimate, others do not, obviously, and that, again, is age, not only your age, Senator, but the age of Mr. Reagan.
Well, I think that age is a factor, and I've never objected to it. I raised it myself when I was decided to run. And your health is a factor. Again, I raised it myself when I decided to run. But it is not a factor that you make the essence of a campaign. Once having given the people an opportunity to look over the candidate, and if it's a medical judgment that's required, once there is authoritative medical evidence, and I'm taking my own case as a good example of that, that should be the end of that issue. It is not an issue to be debated. What difference does it make if Mr. D'Amato and I debate my health? I just will tell you I feel fine, and he'll tell you I'm about to die because he wants to be elected and he thinks that's an argument, incidentally.
Do you see any humor in that, Senator?
Well, I don't see any humor in it particularly. It's pretty ghoulish to me. But as I said before, I'm not insulted and I'm not resentful at anything. I understand these things in my life, but I do think that it becomes unfair when it's pushed over the brink without any regard to the good sense of the voter. Nothing is proved by debating it. I mean, the voter has to trust his own judgment and such evidence as is authoritative and is produced for him.
Does Ronald Reagan die as mayor?
I have no idea.
I'm getting into the issue of age with a bit of some humor, hopefully.
Right. Well, I tell you, I don't.
Both of us, although I've got a ways to go, I've begun as I near my 40th year to lose some of this on my cranium.
I'll take your years any day.
As you look ahead, Senator, to the campaign, beyond the primary, if indeed you are victorious, whom do you look for as your strongest opposition among the field of Democratic candidates?
I haven't the remotest notion. Whoever the Democrats nominate, I will take on.
Why have you chosen, and this has been asked before, but I'd like you to reemphasize that, why have you chosen to seek another term?
Because the seniority, 24 years in the Senate, and before that 8 years in the House, which by the way is the longest any senator from New York has ever remained in the Senate of the United States in all its history since the founding of our republic. The seniority, the experience, the legislative and legal skills, the ability to bridge highly diverse points of view and to find formulae for the purpose, and standing with my colleagues, to which 38 Republican senators testified, excluding only Jesse Helms of North Carolina, have made me feel that in a time of peril, and we are in a time of grave peril, and if you know it as well as I do, I just couldn't walk away from the job that remains to be done when, to me, it felt that my people need me the most. And I know that American elections are not decided out of gratitude for past services, but at least what you've done is an augury of your ability to do what you did the day yesterday, in terms of the techniques of getting things done for your state and for the nation. And secondly, they show you try to keep your promises. I emphasize the word try, because as one legislator, I think my record is high, but in terms of the aggregate number of measures that I have been able to develop myself, of course, it is but a part of the totality of U.S. legislation, which goes through the Senate. But people know that if you try to keep your promises, that represents a big thing for a legislator. And I believe that upon that record, my people would be well advised to send me back, again, I repeat, at a time of such peril. But they don't have to take that for granted, because I haven't turned my back on the job. But it is my reason, my ignition, to present myself to them and to try to again win them to the fact that I can serve them and serve them much better than any of the opposition.
Some of your critics have said that you're more interested in international affairs. You talk about a time of grave peril, and yet there are many who argue there's a time of grave peril here economically, while others say there's a time of grave peril abroad. And before that, your critics have said you're more concerned about problems beyond our shores, specifically, than within this country.
That's incorrect. I'm deeply concerned about both. And I'll tell you an interesting thing, which most people don't realize, that the domestic ties on to the foreign in the sense of national security. This government has never won wars in modern times because we matched our enemy in the war, plane for plane, ship for ship, tank for tank, man for man. We have won them because our industrial machine could pour out the goods to overwhelm any enemy. So that's the domestic. That's productivity. That's research and development. That's the morale of the American working man and woman. And they tie together very closely. Secondly, sure, it's very glamorous. If I go to Sudan as the president of the United States, special envoy, because I'm the ranking member of the Foreign Relations Committee, to talk with the president, Numeri, of of Sudan, on behalf of the United States. A lot of pictures, a lot of stories. What's glamorous about getting a new water system for Hoosick Falls, New York? And so people have an impression because of that, that's my beat, that's my bag. That isn't true. I've got thousands of housing units from one end of the state to the other, water systems, sewer systems, help to companies whose plants would close otherwise. In 1 year, last year, we saved 6,500 jobs and got $35 million worth of support from the federal government and in the Small Business Administration and the Economic Development Administration and so on to do it with. Now, that's 1 year, and that's proliferated in 24 years. So I've got a wonderful staff. I make those calls, which are key, or visits, myself, and we do the job for New York, I think, superbly.
I want to move on to another area abroad, first of all, then come back to New York in the remaining moments of this broadcast, and that is specifically this country's attitude toward Israel and that of the current administration. You have been a very strong advocate of strong policy in support of Israel, and yet within the Congress and the administration, there seems to be almost an eroding or dissolving of that support. Do you feel at times that you're a voice crying in the wilderness?
Oh, no, not at all. Far from it. We had two-thirds of the Senate only 60 days ago, which protested in writing by letter something which Senator Robocoff of Connecticut and I organized to the arming of U.S. fighter aircraft which have been sold to Saudi Arabia for offensive action, something which we had prevented when they were sold, but which now recurred. And two-thirds of the Senate signed on, and a good majority of the House. So the Congress remains firm in the Israeli commitment. And the reason is a very good one, because that commitment, in terms of government, you know, my personal feelings, how I feel about it as a person of Jewish faith, has naturally a certain deep feeling about Israel and Jerusalem, which Muslims and Christians also share, is another matter. But in terms of statecraft, Israel, especially now with Egypt, where the chances of coupling the two are very great, represents the element of stability in the whole turbulent Middle East. It's a meddlesome country. Very excellent army, full of spirit and full of ability, and nobody can take on the Middle East when, or what's called at Geneva, by a whole group of Arab states with Soviet participation at one end, and Israel, the United States, and Egypt at the other. If we get into that one, the whole thing will blow up in our faces. We have to have fortitude to stick with the Camp David Accords, to stick with the Israel-Egypt peace agreement, and however we may feel about those settlements in the West Bank, and I'm not very happy with those that are not necessary for security myself, however we may feel about it, we must bear in mind that the assertions respecting those settlements are very much the same kind of assertions that Begin made when we were talking about the settlements in the Sinai. And when there was a settlement that concluded those. And I believe that when the parties get together on a settlement about the West Bank, hopefully with Jordan in the deal, it will include those settlements as well. I can't tell you what will happen to them, but I believe they will be included within an overall settlement. And the thing to do is to plow ahead on that score. That is the way to go. And if we allow ourselves to get diverted, we'll face disaster.
I'm moving back to the domestic issue, and specifically in Westchester County. Our station does a series of what we call ascertainments for license renewal, as do all radio and television stations in this country. And I've done a good many of those. The leading issues in Westchester are, first of all, lack of affordable, available housing, and secondly, transportation, specifically Conrail. Now, from where you sit in the Senate, is there anything that you see that you could do specifically for those two issues in Westchester County?
Yes, I can, and I have. First, I've been very active in respect of the Northeast Corridor, which Westchester is an element, because it relates to the railroad traffic which moves north and south through that belt of 30 million people from Washington to Boston. Westchester is on the main route, right out of New York City. And we have worked with Conrail in the effort to get them the financing, the equipment, and the management, which is essential in order to try to do better. But we're very short of money. And so urban mass transit, which includes suburban transit, for which the federal government puts up some money, is vital. And we've just had a breakthrough in the sense that we've passed the bill in the Senate, and we have a good chance to work it out in the House, by which there is a federal mass transit funds will be distributed based upon mass transit ridership, mass transit trackage, rather than upon per capita population, the way it has been. And this will make a quantum difference to New York, and very direct difference to Westchester County.
And the issue of housing in about 30 seconds?
Yes, housing has been my great care. I'm one of the authors of about every housing bill in the 24 years I've been there. And we've got to reach up into moderate income housing so that while people may not get a full subvention, as poor people do, they'll get something which will enable them to have decent housing.
My guest for the Westchester News Conference this week, Senator Jacob Javits. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
I'm Frank LaPorte. I really enjoyed this.
Thank you. Well, you're not supposed to. You get paid.
Well, what do you mean? I see, obviously, you must enjoy your job.
Oh, yes. I do very much.
No, what I do is fun. I really enjoyed coming down here to talk.
That's
with
good.
You. And,
one of your reporters who was with us about 2 weeks ago, we were in Westchester.
Steve Cohen.
Could have been.
At the Conrail Station, White Plains, right.
White Plains.
Well, take care.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you. Nice to have met you.
Thank you.
And we might have even given him some literature.
The main issue is who can best serve the people of the state of New York in the United States Senate. That is the issue. And as I see it, my reason for running is that I could not walk away from a job at a time of real peril, both at home and abroad, and who would know it better than I, that the people of New York State have kept me in for 24 years, longer than any senator in its history. So that I learned, even if I didn't know it before, and I did, I came out of the House of Representatives for 8 years, and I was Attorney General of New York, how to do things legislatively, how to get bills passed, how to get things done for my state, how to try to be a real influence in keeping the peace of the world, how to develop formulae which will bridge gaps between people of widely divergent views ought to have an impact in committee, where so many commitments and so much is crystallized that then appears in legislation. All of that, the people of New York State have kept me there to learn and do. And then I just couldn't say no to my own conscience when it came to turning away from it at a time when I'd had all the honors anybody's entitled to, and I could easily have taken it easy and done all those nice things of theater and music and travel that people look forward to in their later years in life. I feel zestful, I'm interested in the job, I like the job, and the feeling of doing something constructive for my people and my time is what animated me. And that's the issue. The issue is, am I better than the other fellow or the other lady who may be offered to them? We don't know yet how these primaries will come out. I'm facing the issue that way. The only thing I say is this. My length of service, one, gives me equipment, and two, assures my constituents that if they return me, I'm a man who tries to keep his campaign promises. I do not regard them lightly at all. And I don't promise everything, because I don't treat it lightly. And I have had a considerable amount of delivery. So to that extent, the record's important. Other than that, it must be considered the first election, because the people have got to be sure that I will do for them in the future what I have done, I believe, effectively, heretofore.
Now, you have, of course, seen the commercials made by the D'Amato campaign.
Unfortunately, yes.
What is your reaction to those commercials?
Well, I think it's pretty low-level campaigning, especially, in the first place, let me say that I'm too experienced to be resentful or angry. If I sounded angry on the television, I apologize to the viewing audience, because naturally, you know, the feeling comes out, no matter how you try to discipline yourself. But what I think deeply concerned me, is rather offensive, was underlying the whole thing was the idea, I wish you were dead. That's pretty ghoulish, you know, and that was coupled with statements in the press which bore out that attitude. And frankly, you know, everybody learns. I learned, I think my opponent may have learned. And he certainly, I hope, will learn after the primary that this is not the kind of tactics and not the kind of resolution of issues between candidates that is looked upon with favor by our people. I've never encountered it. And I've had five Senate and state campaigns. I had one for Attorney General, and four in my district when I was a congressman. I've never encountered this kind of deep personal attack. If my age is an issue, okay, I'm so old, have a look at me, Mr. Citizen, and what's there to debate? In other words, I either am or I'm not able to do the job and have all my marbles, in the sense of having all my faculties and my intellect and whatever else, the character and integrity I bring to the job. If I'm too sick to do it, that'll be very obvious. Or if it isn't, we've had lots of medical testimony on it. I've opened up every record. There's been no claim of privacy or anything else. And I raised the whole thing myself. And I'm delighted I did it, and I know it was the right thing to do. And now the people decide, what is there to debate? So I just felt that debating it was in an effort to make it an issue, and to make it the issue, because this fellow's got nothing else. You know, I've had the record, and I've done the job, and he's a town supervisor, and really, what does he know about how this country runs in those legislative halls and in the United States and the world, and dealing with so many interests and so many senators and so many congressmen?
Well, you're well aware that much has been written and said and debated about how you're feeling these days and whether you'll last 6 years, which in itself may be ghoulish, as you mentioned.
I understand.
How do you feel about that? Does that ever at any moment give you pause to think, well, maybe I'm wrong in doing this?
No, I tell you, it took me a long time to make up my mind. And I consulted the great medical talent. I suppose there is no greater than the little dysfunction that bothers me. The opinion was unanimous, and they've now made it public, these eminent doctors, the Massachusetts General, Memorial in New York, Mayo, Minnesota, you know, this is the class of the field, that I have every right to believe that I will not only last, but be effective and on the job 6 years from now as I am now. And there's certainly no diminution in either my activity or my abilities now.
There's been a lot also said about calling you a reborn Republican, and that the Republican Party in New York State is in total disarray, that Governor Rockefeller was your shield and your support, and that with his passing away, this leaves the party and you in some deep trouble in New York.
Governor Rockefeller was my friend, and I was his friend. It was very mutual. And when he came into the desire to be governor in 58, he came to me through a mutual friend of ours named J.H. Whitney. Still remains a great friend and supporter of mine. And I literally took him in hand. I wasn't the only one, but I did take him in hand. And in a sense, introduce him to working, debating politics. And he turned out to be great at it. I remember, and perhaps some viewers will remember, first introducing him to a huge audience on 7th Avenue in the Garment District, one of his earliest speeches. And when I got all through lining up all the state candidates at that time behind me and saying to the audience, now ask them questions. Well, Nelson almost fell through the platform, but he was great at it immediately. So my memories of him are very fond. And yes, he did run the state organization. It was very helpful to me because it's not my bag to run political organizations. I'm essentially a legislator, a thinker, a planner, a student. And also, I think, pretty good at debate, etc. So I had the legislative talents. He always told me there's anything he didn't think he could ever be a senator. Because he wanted to be the executive. He wanted to see something actually done that you could feel and touch with your hands and see with your eyes. So it was a great division of labor. But unhappily for me and for our country and for our state, Nelson is gone. And it's left to me to do the job that needs to be done, and I'm doing it. I believe I'm doing it effectively and adequately, and I'm very hopeful that the Republicans of the state will agree.
Has the financial support diminished considerably with his passing?
No. I never did get a great sums of money from the Rockefellers or from the Rockefeller family. It's all been made public. It's such an assumption, you know, that because they are a very wealthy family, they gave huge campaign contributions. They did not. They were certainly larger than they are today because of the $1,000 limitation per person. But I think the most that I ever got in a Rockefeller campaign was $35,000 to $50,000 in the whole family. And in the last campaign in 74, a big fuss was made about that by my then opponent, Ramsey Clark, and it turned out to come to nothing when the public went to the polls and voted.
Now, the pundits, I'm sure you know, are saying that if you're going to have any chance at all, weather is a factor, turnout, because of turnout being a big factor, that Mr. D'Amato's supporters are loyal, the kind of people who would come out in any weather, the kind of people that will vote on Tuesday. Do you worry about that?
I always worry about everything. But in answer to that, may I say that the poll just taken by the New York Times, which shows me still adequately ahead,